What's the very first commandment in the Bible? Not the greatest commandment. Jesus gives that status to a particular commandment in Matthew 22. You shall love the Lord with all your heart, soul, and mind. Not the commandment Jesus calls its equal in that same text. You shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. Not those two. I mean the very first commandment, the first directive recorded in the Bible as given by God to humans. Right about the time the world was being lifted from the no of nothing into natural yes. The creation. It's found in Genesis 1, verse 18. It's not love God. It's not love neighbor as self. It is this: be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. In Hebrew, that last phrase, fill the earth, has a sense of replenish the earth. That's it. That's the very first thing we're told to do. The very first moral, ethical responsibility assigned to humans at the genesis of our species. Reproduce and replenish. There's no way not to notice the generative nature of that two-part commission: to be fruitful and to cultivate a fruitful earth. Robin Lovin has said that growth is the central metaphor for United Methodists. It may also be the central metaphor for human existence on the planet Earth. We have, of course, sacred rituals for the first part of that command, of course. It's blessing those who declare their intention to share in covenantal relationship over a lifetime and possibly to raise a family of their own within that union. Wedding ceremonies witness and bless that metaphysical marvel Genesis describes as two becoming one. We just had a wedding ceremony a month ago. I found this silk rose petal just this morning in the sanctuary, an outlier from the day. Jacqueline Krause and David Lozano were married at this altar, the same altar where Jackie's parents had been married 40 years before. Do we need a similar ceremony to the wedding ceremony to bless that other part of the original commandment, that other holy union, our divinely designated partnership with the earth? In refilling, replenishing it. It might go something like this: will you, the human community, receive the earth as your covenant partner through all of human history to honor and to keep, to love and to cherish, until in death you are gathered into earth's generous arms. Theologian Sally McFegg has written that we are part and parcel of the web of life and exist in interdependence with all other beings, both human and non-human. Sounds like wedding language to me. We both depend on the web of life for our own continued existence. And in a special way, we are responsible for its well-being. In other words, we are intrinsically embedded in the natural world. Two becoming one. Psalm 23 is for many of us a heart psalm. As we shared it just now, some of us may have been reciting it from memory. It was taught to me by my grandmother when I was a child, and then I memorized it in Mr. Luton's fourth grade Sunday school class. An intriguing feature lies hidden in the understory of this beloved psalm, something we may not normally notice. The psalmist moves effortlessly between identifying as a sheep, and then as a person, and then as a sheep again, and a person, and a sheep, a fluid sort of shape shifting, leaving the impression that there's a one with nature orientation to the psalmist's identity. The Lord is my shepherd. I'm a sheep. Making me lie down in green pastures, leading me beside still waters, still a sheep. Restoring my soul, a person. Leading me in paths, sheep, of righteousness, person. Yea, though I walk through the valley, sheep. Of the shadow of death I fear no evil, for thou art with me, person. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me, sheep. There's clearly a comfort for the psalmist in being situated within creation, identifying with elements, with creatures of the natural world seems to be second nature. Jesus does the same thing. Unless a seed falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it falls into the earth, it bears much fruit. Is he talking about a seed or himself? Yes. The wind blows where it will, he says elsewhere. We don't know where it comes from or where it goes. Is he referring to the wind or to the Holy Spirit? Yes. This orientation, this worldview is nothing new for the Bible. We could call it the Hebrew cosmology, in which mind and matter, spirit and form, humanity and nature are not separate but conjoined, interwoven, interbeholden, so that we cannot know the dancer from the dance. That way of seeing the world moves us from a binary notion of I versus it, us versus them, one we have also too often employed in the human arena and with devastating effects. To a unified understanding of humanity within the context of the rest of creation. This is where Madeleine L'Engle's words become so helpful. Humans are portion, not pinnacle, of creation. It's the guest in someone's home offering to assist the host in preparing dinner, a meal that will nourish both host and guest alike. In this instance, we are the guests in nature's home. To lend a hand is to nourish ourselves as well. Today's bulletin cover is in front of you, and if you look at that image, it gives us something that suggests the reciprocity, the symbiosis within the human and natural realms. Human hands open in self-giving posture to become the trunk of a tree whose leaves will shade, whose fruit will nourish that very same human being. This synergistic relationship with the earth is the same essential spiritual truth we experience in human exchanges. The prayer of Saint Francis says it best. For it is in giving that we receive. Seeing to your well-being ensures my own, and mine is also your work and reward. The ethical parallel between human interrelationships and those of humans with nature is strikingly apparent in two quotations that virtually mirror one another. In the public sphere, there is one from former Senator Christopher Dodd. We owe it to each other and to our children and grandchildren to leave our planet in a better state than we found it. And then these words from former Ambassador Andrew Young. One of the principles of nonviolence is that you leave your opponents better off than you found them. You leave them whole. Could it be that the way we treat the earth is really also the way we treat one another, dismissively or respectfully, with intent either to exploit or to esteem? Maybe the two first commandments, the ones we find in Genesis, are not so different from the two greatest commandments we find in the Gospels, but rather quite closely interwoven. To love God is to love neighbor, is to love self, is to love the earth, is to love self, is to love neighbor, is to love God. Caring for a huge, hurtling planet involves stratospheric levels of complexity. We all know this. That must be why Jerry Malmen, a climatologist with the National Center for Atmospheric Research, calls it a mega ethical challenge. But there are strategies, and many of them are being implemented, even if in fits and starts, forward, back, on again, off again. Will the church join in, lending our philosophical playbook to the cause? Will Christian communities, congregations, families, friendship groups explore and begin to implement creative, disciplined practices of conservation and care? Replenishing creation is our ethic, our story, our very first commandment. From the day I came to Laurel Heights, I have been so appreciative of how relatively little we throw away, how much we wash instead of toss, how much we reuse and recycle. Good work, church. What's next? What else? How do we lighten our footprint even more congregationally and then teach each other to do so at home and work and travel and even in recreation? Our denomination has a website with ideas for action. It's umcjustice.org. umcjustice.org. Have a look and talk with your small groups, your Sunday school classes, your committee, your family, in your workplace. There's another reason I'm thinking the climatologists call this a mega ethical challenge, one that has nothing to do with the vastness of the problem or the complexity of the solutions involved. It has more to do with the will of those of us with the resources and influence to undertake those actions, rather than deciding we just couldn't be bothered. Those are Barbara Kingsolver's stinging words as she imagines grandparents explaining to a grandchild why the earth is in such growing ecological distress. You see, child, we were always so focused on pursuing the fastest, cheapest, easiest, most expedient ways to experience what we always called the good life, consuming and disposing our way across the planet. I guess we just couldn't be bothered with considering the ecological implications of our way of life for your quality of life once you came along. Sorry, honey. Let that not be our conversation with our children and grandchildren and those children within our care in this community of faith. Let our conversation say this: we acted. We provided the framework in our theology and spirituality as disciples of Jesus Christ to esteem rather than dismiss creation. Back to the psalm. What if we think of those beautiful, pristine opening phrases as commingling? Green pastures, still waters, restoreth my soul. In Hebrew, it's returns my soul to me. With green pastures and still waters, you return my soul to me. I hope all of us here have had that spiritual experience at some point. It's time for a whole species to experience it. The replenishing of the earth returning to us our very souls. Surely, goodness and mercy will follow.